Sanctify my heart.
Sanctify my heart.
Make it ready for you.
And make it ready for you.
Welcome to this broadcast of Sanctify My Heart, a ministry of the Troy Church of Christ featuring Minister James Glasscock. If possible, grab your Bible and join us in today's study.
Good afternoon and welcome to Sanctify My Heart. My name is James Glasscock, and I am the minister at the Troy Church of Christ. And as always, I welcome you to our broadcast and encourage you to get out your Bible and follow along as we study God's Word today. For the month of August, we are looking at men and women of courage and faith. And last week, we looked at Joshua and Caleb, who in the Old Testament, in the book of Numbers, chapter 13, were two of 12 spies that were chosen by Moses to go and spy out the land of Canaan, a land that had been promised by God to the people of Israel. Now, this land was promised to them. It was going to be theirs. All they had to do was obey and trust the Lord, and it would be theirs. But when 10 of the 12 spies saw it, they said, "Oh, I don't know if we can do this. Those people are big. They're mighty. The walls of their cities are big. We can't do this. It's too much." But Joshua and Caleb stood up in faith and encouraged and trusting God's promises and said, "No." Caleb said, "Yes, we can do this. We can do this." And so they were eventually rewarded for their faith. Of those 12 spies, they were the only two who ever actually entered into the promised land, all because they trusted God. They had a vision that was tuned by faith in God, and they stood up for what He had promised them. Now, this week, we are in the book of Esther. And by the way, you can get that lesson off our website, troychurch.org, troychurch.org, anytime. This week, we are in the book of Esther, looking at, of course, Esther, who was a woman who was chosen to be the queen for Ahasuerus or Xerxes, depending on how his name is translated, who was the king there. And this is all in Esther chapter 1. We're going to be kind of flying through the book, so if you've got your Bible, I encourage you to follow along, but I also encourage you to go back and read the book. It's very short, just, you know, several chapters. And read this for yourself and get all the details, because today is going to be a little bit of a jet tour through the book of Esther. But I'm fascinated by her story because, well, a few reasons. One, Esther is interesting because it is the only book or letter in all of the Bible that never mentions God by name. And the funny thing is that if you're familiar with the story of Esther and you're familiar with the book of Esther and you're familiar with her and her faith, then hearing that is actually surprising. And I remember, young Christian, the first time I ever heard it, I had already read the book of Esther and heard the story of Esther as well, taught by others. And somebody mentioned that to me, and I thought, no, that can't be right. So I go back through the book, looking everywhere I can, and I couldn't find it. And sure enough, it's true. God is never mentioned by name. And yet, and this is why I encourage you to read the whole book straight through on your own. You will read the book and you will see God over and over again. You will see His providence. You will see His working. You will see faith in Him, even though He isn't mentioned by name. It's one of those things where actions speak louder than words, and the actions of Esther and the actions of her cousin Mordecai, whom we'll get to here in a minute, their actions speak of faith, and they speak of trusting God, even though they don't mention Him by name. Actions speak louder than words. That's probably a little bonus lesson for today. So I'm fascinated with the book for that reason. I'm fascinated with her example, and the tremendous courage she had, the faith she had, the care she had for others. And so I want to look at that today. Let's look at a little bit of background. Let's set this up. That's what the letter does. That's what this book does. In chapter 1, we are introduced first to King Xerxes. And he was a king, it says in chapter 1, verse 1, over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. And at that time, verse 2, at that time King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes, the nobles of the provinces were present. Now get this, this is in verse 4. For a full 180 days, to you and me, that's 6 months. 6 months. He displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. Verse 5, when these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. Because, you know, after 6 months of showing off, and that's basically what he's doing. 6 months he takes to show off, you know, all of the splendor. And you can imagine if this was done now, it would have been done with parades and fireworks and military marches and all kinds of mess. And this is what he does. You know, you can kind of picture, if you're like me and you grew up when the Soviet Union still existed, those May Day parades when the communist leader would stand up there and all of the military of the Soviet Union, all representatives of them would pass in front, and tanks would go by and missiles would go by and all of these things. Everybody would be marching by in honor of the great Soviet leader. Same idea. And he shows off to his people. He shows off to dignitaries from other places, nobles and officials, for 6 months. Okay, a day is an interesting parade, right? 6 months is just showing off. And after that, he has a banquet that lasts for 7 days. And this banquet is, if he had come from a later time, frankly, if he had been Roman, it probably would have been called a Roman orgy, because this is basically what's going on. He has for 6 months unlimited food, unlimited drink, unlimited alcohol, and says, you know, all of these people who are here, you give them whatever they want. Verse 8, for example, says, by the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man whatever he wished. And then his wife enters the picture. And his wife is not yet Esther. We're not to her yet. At this time, the queen of the Medo-Persian Empire is a woman named Vashti. And she also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace. And on the seventh day, it says in verse 10, on the seventh day, Xerxes is, you know, he's been showing off. He's drunk out of his gourd. Everybody else there is drunk out of their gourd. And when you get ungodly, drunk men in a situation like this, whatever they want, they tend to make some of the world's worst mistakes. And that's what happens here. King Xerxes decides he wants to show off his wife, the queen, Vashti, and he has her summoned in. He wants to display her beauty. He wants to show her off, and basically wants her to parade around nude in front of all of his guests, these nobles and officials. The dude is drunk. What he's doing is incredibly sexist and vile, but this is what he decides he wants to do. This is what happens, again, when ungodly people do stupid things. By the way, that doesn't mean, when I say ungodly, I don't mean Christian versus the rest of the world. Because if a Christian's in the same situation, which would be against their faith and against their morals, but if they are being a hypocrite and they're in the same situation, they're going to be just as stupid. You mark my words. So this is what happens. Well, she comes in. She wants no part of this. It is beneath her as a woman. It's beneath her dignity as a woman. It is beneath her dignity as the queen of this nation. And it is beneath her dignity representing the king. She does not want to do this. And, you know, good for her. She doesn't want to do this. However, the king gets very angry. And long story short, because, you know, we only have so much time and there's a lot here. Long story short, the king gets angry. Some of his officials and advisors suggest that, you know, if it word gets out that she told you no, because she does, she tells him no. If word gets out that she tells you no, all of the women are going to rise up and they're going to get angry. Well, yeah, and they should. But this is what they say. They go to the king and say, King, if you don't make an example of your wife for disobeying you, then, you know, the rest of our wives, they're not going to listen to us either, and they're going to get angry. And they're going to be wondering why we were at a party like this and what was going on, and we are going to be in serious hot water. Of course, that's seriously earned and deserved hot water, but that's not the way they saw it. So, in order to keep their thumbs down on their women, and in order to preserve their false reputation of integrity, they decide that the king should punish Vashti by removing her crown and no longer letting her serve as queen of the empire. Well, the king agrees. Okay, not a principled man here, but we knew that already. He agrees. After a while, they come to him and they say, "You know, king, you still need a queen. You don't have a new queen yet. You need a queen." So he makes a ruling. This is chapter 2. He makes a ruling that all the young virgins should be brought before him, and he'll pick a new queen. Well, when that happens, a man named Mordecai, who himself is a Jew, he hears about it. He has a cousin whom he is raising, a younger cousin whom he is raising as an adopted daughter. His uncle, she is his uncle's daughter. His uncle and aunt had passed away. She was an orphan. He takes her in, adopts her, and takes her as his own. So, according to the edict, he sends her right on up. Again, long story short, Esther catches the attention of King Xerxes. She is beautiful. She seems to be also wise and smart, intelligent, beautiful, and he is smitten with her. And very quickly, well, I say very quickly, if you read chapter 2, I mean, it takes a year. It takes a full year just to apply makeup, fragrances, and spices, the chapter says, according to their traditions, just to present her to the king for the very first time. So not quickly on our standard, but on their standard, very quickly he is smitten by her after he meets her, and she becomes the queen of the Medo-Persian Empire and the wife of King Xerxes. And again, he loves her, he is smitten by her, and he respects her. It doesn't sound like he respected Vashti much, but he respects Esther. Not long after this, Mordecai, who would make sure that he happened to pass by the palace area in which the harem was kept and where Esther would have been, he happens to pass by, and he gets regular updates. How is Esther doing? How is Queen Esther doing? And so he gets regular updates, and they stay in communication with each other. They have to do it kind of through back channels, because normally anybody, whether the fact that he's a Jew would complicate things, but he certainly would not have been able to have communication with anyone in the harem and things like that, and neither would any other subject of the kingdom. So, you know, they're kind of having to do it in a bit of a sneaky way, but he just happens to pass by, you know, the window of that building every day and is able to keep in touch. Now, all this time, we're told here in chapter 2, all this time, Esther keeps a secret, the fact that she is Jewish. Verse 10 of chapter 2 says, Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. He does not think it's safe for her to do so. And we're going to find out that his wisdom on this was dead on. It was not safe for her to reveal this. Mordecai, one day, is sitting at the gates. This is chapter 2 and the latter half, starting in verse 19. He is sitting at the city gates, and there are two guys there who are plotting to overtake the king. They were angry, and they decided the king needs to die. And so they're plotting an assassination of the king. This is all in chapter 2, verse 21. Mordecai hears about it. He tells Esther, his cousin and adopted daughter, he tells Esther about this. Esther then tells King Xerxes. She makes sure that the word gets to him, and she makes sure that the word gets to Xerxes that it was Mordecai that uncovered the plot. And so he has it written down in the official records. Mordecai is the man who uncovered this plot, you know, blessed be Mordecai sort of stuff. Make sure that this guy receives honor because he has saved my life and saved the kingdom, and he's a patriot, you know, that sort of a thing. And so that goes down in the records. But other than going down in the records, not much else happens about it. Well, in the meantime, there are other problems that happen. Mordecai he's a guy of principle. He's a guy who, again, even though you never hear them talk about God by name, he's a man who clearly is a devout and godly man and a devout Jew. Well, he doesn't bend his knee when this particular court official keeps coming by, and this court official's name is Haman. And Haman had been working his way up the political ladder. And he's just one of those slimy, marmy kind of guys, you know, just kind of take everything that you think of the worst stereotypes of a politician, and you've got Haman, okay? He is an opportunist. He does not care about anybody or anything except Mr. Haman. And all he wants is recognition and pomp, and he wants everybody to bend their knee whenever he walks by. Well, that's where the problem comes in. The king has elevated him, this is chapter 3, verse 1, and given him a seat of honor higher than anybody else in all of the nobility in the Medo-Persian Empire. In verse 2, all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai, it says, would not kneel down or pay him honor. Mordecai looked at the kind of man that Haman was, and he said, I don't bend my knee to men like that. I don't. And I won't. And he didn't. Well, Haman, being typical for an arrogant, slimy, opportunist politician dude, Haman gets mad. Haman gets very mad. Haman gets so mad that at first he thinks, I want to have Mordecai killed. But he says, that's not really good enough. I don't think I just want to have Mordecai killed. Mordecai's a Jew. I think I should have all the Jews killed. And he decides that he is going to make a way for all of the Jewish people living in the Medo-Persian Empire to be slaughtered, genocide to happen, all because of his own ego, which has been bruised by one man, Mordecai. And so he gets to work. And what does he do? He gets the ear of King Xerxes. And again, this king seems pretty influenced. He's easily influenced by alcohol. He's pretty easily influenced by his advisors. And now he's going to be pretty easily influenced by King Xerxes. Verse 8. Haman says to Xerxes, there is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all other people. Oh, no, what? They're different? And, you know, may it never be. And so that's the first thing that he says about them. You know, these people are different. These people are different. You know, you should always be aware of people who are quick to write people off, judge people, and everything else because they're different. You know, always leads to huge problems. And this is the case with Haman. Haman goes, you know, they're different. They don't do things the way we do them. They don't value what we value. They don't this. They don't that. And then he says, and they don't obey the king's laws. Well, was that true? No, but Haman's not concerned with truth. He's not a man of integrity. Haman's an opportunist. So he lies. And so he says, they're not the same as us. And, you know, they don't listen to your laws. And especially this guy named Mordecai, you know. But he doesn't mention him by name at this point. But that's what's on his mind, especially this guy named Mordecai. He says, they don't listen to your laws. And I don't think it's in your best interest to put up with them anymore. He says, if it pleases the king, this is verse 9, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver in the royal treasury for men who carry out this business. Now, again, if the king was a guy of integrity, this would have been a huge red flag. First off, why do you want me to exterminate people? Secondly, and why are you willing to pay for it? But the king doesn't. The king persuaded, I don't know why, but persuaded by Haman's words, takes his signet ring and gave him what he wanted, and even tells him, you keep the money and do with the people as you please. You know, he had trusted Haman, which was stupid on his part, but that's what he did. This decree goes out. It's sent out in the language of every language of the empire, and he has it decreed throughout. Of course, Mordecai eventually hears about, because everybody hears about, this edict that on a particular day, this is all going to happen. You can read all about that in the second half of chapter 3 of Esther. Mordecai hears, verse 1 of chapter 4, when Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. That was the way you expressed sorrow. It was the way you expressed dismay. It was the way that you express these things in his culture. And he goes out in sackcloth and ashes, wailing loudly. But he went out only as far as the king's gate, because when you were in sackcloth and ashes, you weren't allowed to go any further. And in every corner of the empire, the edict was heard. Well, Mordecai, and this is the first half of chapter 4, Mordecai then makes sure that Esther gets word. He sends word to Esther that this is what's happening, and they talk a little bit back and forth. And then in verse 12, Esther sends the message back to Mordecai. And I said verse 12, but actually I want to look back to verse 11 first. She wrote, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death." Now she's saying this because Mordecai is pressuring her and saying, "You've got to go talk to the king. You need to reveal who you are. You need to reveal to him. Maybe that'll change his mind. You've got to talk to the king and stand up for your people." She writes back and says, "But Mordecai, you know that anybody who goes into the king who hasn't been asked to come and speaks out of turn, basically, that person's a dead person." This is Mordecai's statement. Verse 12, "When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer, 'Do not think that because you were in the king's house, you alone of all Jews will escape. For in you, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this?'" Now, I got to tell you, this is my favorite passage in this book, and one of my favorite passages, period. Because Esther is understandably afraid. I don't think she's just afraid of the fact that she might die. I don't think it's that simple. I don't think she's that shallow. That's not the impression I get of her. I think she's thinking, what good will it do? I'll be dead before I can speak a word. I think she's afraid it won't do anything. She won't be able to accomplish anything because she'll never even get a chance. Mordecai writes back though and says, "Listen, you're going to die one way or the other. You will be found out, and you will die, and your family will die. We will all perish if you don't speak up. And even if we don't," he says, "if anything's to be done, it'll be because God raises up somebody else, but you will still be gone." And I love this line, "But how do you know but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this?" This is one of those places where you go, didn't he mention God? Well, he doesn't, but he is. Because he's talking about providence, the working of God in the world. He's saying, you don't know but that God has put you in this position, at this time, with this ability to go before the king for this reason. This could be why you are where you are. Well, those words sink in with Esther. And she writes back, I'll do it. And she goes before the king. And again, the custom was, as she says, if you weren't summoned, maybe you live, maybe you don't. It was pretty much considered automatically you were going to die. There was one chance she might live. If the king gave a signal, leave her alone, it would be all right. Well, on the third day, verse 1 of chapter 5, on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. And when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter. See, that was the sign that it was all right. At that moment, she knew she might have a hearing. He holds out the scepter that was in his hand, so Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. The king then asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you." Verse 4, "If it pleases the king, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared." So she sets up this banquet. At this banquet, she is going to reveal Haman's plot for what it really is. And she is going to make known this horrible, horrible thing that the king has agreed to and why it doesn't need to happen. But before that happens, starting in verse 9, before that happens, the king, in verse 8, has a dream, and he can't sleep very well. And so he gets up, and he does like a lot of us do. He decides to read. Well, what he decides to read is interesting. Again, it's one of those things where you see providence. You see God working, even though he's not mentioned by name. He goes and he reads, and he decides to read the records, the court records. When he does, he comes across Mordecai's revelation of the plot. And what does he do? He says, you know, did we ever do anything about that? Because this guy really deserves honor. He saved my life. And what happens? He decides to give a parade for Mordecai, and he makes Haman lead Mordecai out in the parade. Irony, don't tell me God doesn't have a sense of humor, okay? Because God works it together by his providence that the guy who plots all this, the guy who hates Mordecai, is the guy who has to lead his horse, lead his ride through the parade. Is that not just a little, it's just a bonus, but isn't that just a little bit awesome to see the humor of God in these things? The sense of irony, the sense of justice, divine justice. Well, again, long story short, jump into verse 7. Or chapter 7. Esther, again, has a quorum with the king here. He asks her, what is your request? And she answers, if I have found favor with your king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life, this is my petition, and spare my people, this is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. But it's not just that. He says, who is he? Where's the man who dared to do such a thing? She says, the adversary and enemy is this vile Haman. Now, I encourage you to read the rest of the book. We don't have time today. But read what happens to Haman. Because the rest of the book of Esther is, the next couple of chapters, is dealing with that. And you see him get what he frankly deserves. But we don't really want to focus on him. We want to focus on Esther. Here is a woman who is brought by the providence of God into a place where she needs to be at the right moment. People who have no voice of their own to stand up for themselves, who are slated to be the subjects of genocide and Holocaust, are given a voice through Esther, but only because she had the faith, the courage, and the conviction to do so. Many times in our lives, and it may not be something so big, it may just be that you need to stand up for your kids, it may be that you need to stand up for your spouse, it may need that you may need to stand up for someone at work, you may need to stand up for someone who's being abused. You know, there have been a lot of news stories about people where nobody stood up, and that's wrong. It is wrong. Sometimes they weigh their costs. You know, look at the whole Paterno mess in Sandusky. Somebody should have stood up. There were no Esthers in that room. But Esther stood up. And by faith and by courage and conviction, this woman saved an entire race of people that day because she was willing to do the right thing. We need to be people like that. And I'll tell you this too. We need people like Mordecai in our lives. You make sure you have friends that surround you, relatives that surround you, that will encourage you to do the right thing. They will hold you accountable and say, but how do you know but that you aren't right where you are for such a time as this?
Sanctify my heart.
Sanctify my heart.
Make it ready for you.
And make it ready for you.
We hope that you have been built up in your faith in God today during the study of His Word. If you would like to know more about the hope and grace that are in Jesus Christ, please visit us at the Troy Church of Christ. This broadcast is a ministry of the Churches of Christ, and if you would like to know more about our congregation, or if you would like to contact us with questions about today's study, please call us at 518-833-6825 or email us at troychurch@gmail.com. Our website will also provide more information, and you can download a free copy of this broadcast at troychurch.org. You may also write us at the Troy Church of Christ, P.O. Box 654, Wyanskill, New York, 12198. If you live in the Capital District and would like to join us for worship, we meet at 185 Main Avenue in Wyanskill, New York, every Sunday at 10 a.m. We also have children's worship and a special Bible class for children's ages 2 to 12, during the message on Sundays. God bless you, and join us again next Saturday, 3 p.m. for Sanctify My Heart.
And make it ready for you.
And make it ready for you.